15 women accompanied to Reserve Bank of India, and we went to Mumbai. And when we went to meet the director of Reserve Bank of India, I wasn't sure what our women are going to talk, but I could see the confidence on their face. So our women said to the director that you rejected or you denied the license because we cannot read and write. But when we were growing in the villages, there were no schools, so we are not responsible. And they challenged the director that, you know, ask us to calculate the interest of any principal amount. If we fail, don't issue the license. But tell your officers to do it without calculator and see who can calculate faster. Needless to say that we got the banking license. And women actually proved that we cannot read and write, but we can count.
Hello and a warm welcome to a very special podcast series, Unusual Suspects. I'm your host, Gaurav Chaudhary. This is a series about unraveling stories of entrepreneurs, investors, and businesses, professionals, and of course, philanthropists who are disruptors, yet not in your face. Their disruptions have consistently delivered on the purpose and the mission they've embarked on. Their values are as strong as the mission. Unusual Suspects streams on earshot.in, spotify.com, Apple Podcast, YouTube, moneycontrol.com, and a host of other podcast streaming platforms and directories. Welcome to the third season of Catalyzing Change, the Power of Philanthropy, in collaboration with GivingPie, India's first family-focused philanthropy network. As philanthropy in India evolves, a new wave of giving is emerging, one that prioritizes collaboration, trust-based models, and long-term systemic change. Over the next few episodes, we will turn our focus on gender and philanthropy, exploring how strategic giving can advance equity and empowerment for all genders. Through conversations with leading philanthropists, change makers, and sector experts, we will uncover what it takes to drive meaningful impact, where philanthropy can step in to bridge critical gaps, and how collaboration can accelerate progress. Each episode will spotlight a different facet of gender-focused giving. In this episode, From the Ground Up, How Philanthropy Can Support Women's Economic Empowerment, we will explore what philanthropy can learn from grassroots experience in building sustainable livelihoods for women in rural and semi-urban India. We'll discuss how strategic giving can unlock economic opportunities, strengthen financial independence, and drive long-term shifts in agency and inclusion. I'm delighted to have with me Chetna Galasina. Chetna is the founder president of Mandeshi Foundation, which she set up in 1996 with the aim of economically and socially empowering rural women. In 1997, she founded the Mandeshi Mahila Sehkari Bank, India's first bank for and by rural women. Ever since, she has championed empowering women to create a supportive environment where women micro-entrepreneurs can successfully grow their businesses and be valued by their families and communities. Welcome to the show, Chetna. Delighted to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me for this show.
You know, Chetna, let's start with a very context-setting kind of a question for my own understanding and also for the understanding of our listeners. You know, you have spent years working to empower women in rural and semi-urban India, and that is an experience that very few people will have. Very rich, very diverse, and also something that you bring along for nearly three decades now. If you can elaborate a little bit on your journey, what motivated you to start this work? What were the triggers behind starting this? And how has the journey evolved? I'm sure there would have been challenges, but you have overcome those. And what are the lessons you've learned?
So actually, three decades ago, I started this Mandeshi Foundation and Mandeshi Bank, which I never thought that I'll start and go into the villages and work there. I am born and raised in Mumbai, and I was never thinking of getting into this sector also. But coincidentally, when I was in university, in Mumbai University, I met Jayaprakash Narayan, a renounced Gandhian leader who was going from campuses to campuses, meet the young students, and he was actually appealing youth that young people should work in the villages of India. Real Bharat is in village. And with this whole idea that Real Bharat is in village, we need to work in the villages, I was very fascinated. And so I traveled with Jayaprakash Narayan in countryside of India. And while traveling, I met my husband, who is a farmer and was leading a farmers movement. Fell in love, decided to marry him. And I left Mumbai and shifted to his village in Masward in Satara district in Maharashtra. Both of us started working with the farmers, wage laborers in the drought-stricken area of Maharashtra, Masward, in Satara district. For me, that whole thing of seeing how drought can create problems for the people in rural area was my first exposure. I still remember that when I used to go to the work site of the people where they are working as a wage laborer or on the government scheme, which now we have NAREGA, at that time it was Employment Guarantee Scheme, where I saw that in that area, majority of the men migrated, but women were working on the sites where they were breaking stones. And I felt like, you know, that actually, is that when I saw women breaking stones, I felt, is that work which humans should do it? I asked this question myself. And I felt, where have I seen such scenes? And I remember that you see these things in Bollywood cinema, where somebody is like under the punishment and going through a rigorous life imprisonment. And then they are actually forced to do such work like breaking the stone. And the question came in my mind, like, these women have not done any crime and why they have to do that work. So that made me think that, you know, I would want to stay here, work here with these women. And it was very interesting when I always would communicate with these women that what they want, or, you know, how do they are looking to change their lives. And the one thing which actually was very striking, that they never asked anything from the government, or, you know, but what they were actually expecting or they were asking is, like, these women who are wage laborers, who are fruit vendors, who are milk vendors, the one common thing which I heard from them was that they wanted to save money. And I was like, you know, if you want to save money, the best place is to go to the banks and open the account. But these women, they said that banks are not opening the account. You know why? Because their savings were too small. They wanted to save 2 rupees, 3 rupees a day. Because they said that we get our wages either weekly or fortnightly. We don't get salaries monthly. Fruit vendors said that our cash flows are daily. So the facility which they wanted from the bank was that if they can save daily, that would be really helpful for them to save. And so I went with them to the banks to open their account. The bank managers were not very interested at all. In fact, they said that these women are not an affordable client for us. And I felt that banks are here in the village. Women are here who want to save. But still, these women do not get an opportunity to go to these banks. And then they lose their cash because they cannot save. It's in-house. It can be used by the family members. And they cannot plan anything. So then I thought that if banks are not opening the account, why not start the bank for these women? And that's how I got into this whole process of setting up the bank for these women. I went directly to the Reserve Bank of India in Mumbai. At that time, it was Bombay. And I just inquired that how can we set up the women's bank? Fortunately, at that time, actually, there was a window open at Reserve Bank of India to set up the Women's Cooperative Bank. And so I thought, why don't we apply for under this category? And so we decided to apply for the banking license for Mahila Cooperative Bank, Women's Cooperative Bank. I went back and discussed with women, and then we actually made the proposal to apply for the banking license to Reserve Bank of India. I went to give the application. Reserve Bank denied accepting the proposal of Mahila Bank because our promoting members were non-literate. They had a thumb instead of signature. So they said, we cannot issue a license to the bank whose promoting members are non-literate. I was nervous. I came back. And when I was sharing this experience with our women, I was literally crying. But you know what? Women actually said that, you know, bank license has been denied because we cannot read and write. Why are you so upset? We will learn to read and write from today. And our literacy classes started. After 5 months, we applied again. But at that time, I didn't go alone. With me, 15 women accompanied to Reserve Bank of India, and we went to Mumbai. And when we went to meet the director of Reserve Bank of India, I wasn't sure what our women are going to talk, but I could see the confidence on their face. So our women said to the director that you rejected or you denied the license because we cannot read and write. But when we were growing in the villages, there were no schools, so we are not responsible. And they challenged the director that, you know, ask us to calculate the interest of any principal amount. If we fail, don't issue the license. But tell your officers to do it without calculator and see who can calculate faster. Needless to say that we got the banking license. And women actually proved that we cannot read and write, but we can count. And our meeting went on for nearly 3 hours. And we came back. Till 5 months, we were like, you know, we may get license, we may not get license. We were not sure. But then after 5 months, I got a call from Reserve Bank of India that you didn't come here to collect the license. We have posted your license. This is the first rural women bank, and this is the first bank where Reserve Bank has dispatched the license by post. So that's how we got the banking license. And it actually, when we set up the bank, the whole thing was that around the area, the capital was mobilized by women. So it was the first rural women bank which actually mobilized the community capital. Women came together. There were no outside investment. Women owned saving, women owned credit. And with the community capital and with the local board, this bank was set up. So I do feel that this was something very, very different. Even the experience was very different for the central bank. Seeing that, right. Yes.
You know, it's very interesting, and it reminds me of an experience that one of my friends had recently narrated, and we were discussing literacy in the context of financial literacy. About 10 years ago, he happened to go to Hampi, and where he bought something from a woman hawker, and he paid the money, and then she opened up the box and said that you can take the change from the box. She was not literate, so she did not know how to count change. And this was, we're talking about just about 10 years ago, and I can imagine how things could have been so very different and difficult 30 years ago. Also, financial, a bank account opens up a whole new world of opportunities for many people, something that we only have got to realize the very hard way, because if you're not part of the savings finance ecosystem in the formal sense, which comes from a bank account, then you are left out from a whole world of opportunities. So thank you so much, Chetna, for setting the context and detailing how you went about building this. But let me take you back. Let me change tack a bit and get to, you know, try and understand from you about carrying out philanthropic work in India, because this requires while there's a certain joy in giving and which we all understand and can relate to, but it also requires money. And given your experience, very wide-ranging experience, you must have worked with a lot of funders and also communities. What is the kind of philanthropic support that has been the most effective in trying to bring about real change for women, particularly in villages? Chetna?
Yes. So it was very interesting that, as I said, that, you know, this whole financial needs and services which were given to the women, women themselves said that, you know, that is not enough. They said that we want to manage finance, we want to learn, we want to set up the enterprise, we want to understand. As you mentioned, right, that when you went to Hampi, women showed you that, okay, take out the change, which clearly indicated, and even at that time, women said that we want to understand how do we manage finance. So we realized that we need a foundation which actually will help women or support women to understand these, to build the capabilities of running the businesses. And so we decided, why don't we start a business school for rural women? Because bank is there, but the needs are the handholding and supporting to set up the business, get the skill training and all. And then it was like, you know, various funders, because Mandeshi Foundation is a charity-based organization. So we started the skilling and building the capacity of women through business school. And we started, and a lot of funders actually came forward to support Mandeshi to set up this business school. But it is very interesting that, you know, now suppose we have this whole CSR where the funding, the philanthropic money, how does it come? Like philanthropic money comes either by the family philanthropic or which is more a trust-based philanthropic. And now in India, you get it through CSR support or the institutions who do philanthropy. So we approached the funders and we did get funding to set up the business school for rural women, where these all trainings were given. And the whole approach was very comprehensive, that the foundation with the philanthropic money can provide the training to these women. We developed the Deshi MBA program, and then bank provides the loan. But the one thing we always kept, I mean, we were very cautious about that with the funders also, that see, if you have a 1 year contract, or if you say we will support 1 year, or if you say we will support 3 years, and then we'll have an exit plan, we requested the funders that cannot happen, because it's not like, it's a generation of so many, these women were always excluded. And when you want to include them and you want to go towards, when you're working with the people and including them, people are very much, they don't see the problem solving in a very short term. They want to create wealth for themselves. And if you want to support that, you have to have a patience. And you have to listen to people what they want instead of teaching them. So it was very clear that our women wanted that, we want the training and skilling training to set up the businesses. And if we set up the business and want to successful, it will take time. We just saw that, you know, when we were setting up the business school, and then later on when they set up the business, then they wanted a market linkage. So we had to tell our funders that, okay, let us walk the journey with our women, that they want to set up the business, now they want a market linkage, how do we support them? So we set up the Chambers of Commerce for these women entrepreneurs. So we took our funders from skill training to the Chambers of Commerce, where you scale your business, market your business. And I'm so proud to share with you that some of the funders walked the journey for nearly more than a decade. And as a result, today, we have been able to impact 1 million women entrepreneurs. This would have not been possible if the funders would have not trusted us, number one, and would have not listened to our women. So I do think that funders should listen to the women communities. If they listen, I think the solutions will be much more impactful.
Absolutely. And 1 million, you know, touching the lives of 1 million women is clearly massive milestones, a milestone. Many congratulations for that and my compliments. But that said, despite the efforts of various stakeholders from the CSR community to the corporate world to the institutional funding community, you know, particularly for with a focused attention on advancing women's empowerment, critical challenges do persist. In your view, Chetna, what do you think what are the obstacles that you think funders face, and how do you think we should navigate them?
Many times, you know, some issues are on a very big scale, and sometimes funders are not sure that how they will be able to address that. So let me give you an example that, say, at the time of COVID, right, that actually the what we saw with the experience at Mandeshi, that during COVID, you saw migration, people are coming back and all that, and lot of organizations were getting into relief work. But we saw that that was not enough. It was actually, there was so much need. And a lot of our women also said that, you know, relief work is great, but we do not, in our area, we were in villages, there were no CT scan, there were no hospitals operating. And so we appealed to our funders that, you know, we should work with the government. And why don't we actually work with the government and not only just do the relief work and limit ourselves to that, but actually crack the real problem and see that the problem is solved. Funders were a bit hesitant to work with the government. And I can understand that there are, like, you know, the problems sometimes you have while working with the government. But sometimes we have to take the bold decision and listen. And I would like to share that at that time, we could convince the sub-funders, and we ran the hospitals with the government on public-private partnership model. And because of that, in Satara district, we could run 3 hospitals, and we could actually, that was the one big impact, was that because so many migrant population came, vaccination, everything was given in time. Sometimes things are very different than the regular work. So funders would have challenge to take the decision, divert the work. But when you're working with the communities and their lives are so fragile, that you have to listen and take the bold decision. And I do think that funders will have to learn. I think the lessons you learned from the communities are very important. And funders should always have eyes and ear open to the voice of community. And if community feels that, and so I would like to share that with this, we saw that while working with the government, another big thing can, one big impact can happen is that you become an instrumental to the change in policies also. Because after the COVID experience, what we saw was that all the government, I mean, including the primary healthcare centers, everybody wanted to work, and we created a path where the community organizations and the government, local bodies in the government, they work together. Then the impact automatically, I mean, the scale comes in, right? So I do think that funders get hesitant to work with the government, but it is very important to work with the government if you really want to make changes in the policies, if you really want to scale up, because just community organizations will scale up much more fast when they are partnering with the government.
Absolutely, Chetna. Finally, you know, the final question is about India itself. It's a broader question, and 2047 is a milestone year for India. We complete 100 years of independence, and achieving gender equity remains one of the proclaimed objectives and goals that we need to achieve within that year, and a milestone that all of them will make all of us proud of. This will, of course, require very sustained commitment from all stakeholders. In your experience, what must funders do differently to bring about a deeper, more long-term impact on women's empowerment, Chetna?
Yes, this is very important. I mean, when we are achieving, we are going towards the 100th year of independence, and when we are at the mode or at the juncture where India has played a leading role in digitization, right? And so we have like so many opportunities are opened for the communities because of that digitization. Already, India has, I mean, even in the remote locations, we see that women are using digital transactions, financial transactions. But the most important thing in a country like India, where there are so many villages, there are so many weekly hearts. There is, I mean, in metro cities are very cohesive in a way, but the rural areas are more fragmented. In that situation, how do we see or how do we make that, economic empowerment is fully achieved by women? And with this, I see that the most important part what philanthropic organization can do is one, work with the government, but also try to see that whatever solutions we give, we unlock the private capital. When I say that unlock the private capital, I don't only say through CSR, but I see more as, now we have a social stock exchange now, and there are various startups. A lot of people are innovating on financial models. So how do we do that? And I would like to say that in case of Mandeshi, that we have been working that how do we bring the patient capital for women entrepreneurs, where they may require not a loans with that high interest, but the patient capital which will sit as an acquired a capital with no return as an equity in the businesses, and they can scale the business. So I do see that philanthropic money, unlocking the private capital, and with the government policies which are more friendly to the grassroots people, can really make the change. And while working with Mandeshi, we have always seen that, in one village, if there are, say, 15 successful women entrepreneurs who are doing e-commerce, who are doing business, what is the impact? The one impact is migration is not there. The second impact is that they are learned, second generations are going for better education, health is improved, and with this, the economy also grows. So I do think that philanthropic and private capital together with the government scale, actually, with the 100th year of independence, we can actually see that we are in the index of the world. We are not far behind as far as women economic empowerment is concerned, because we need to see ourselves. And also, there are like today we see that majority of the women entrepreneurs are solo entrepreneurs. So today we have to take the decision that how do these women are scaling their business, and they will not only be the job seekers, but job creators. So I think if we work together at the 100th year of independence, we will see that so many women are actually creating jobs. And that would be a big achievement that India leads in creating jobs for women by women entrepreneurs.
Absolutely, Chetna. Thank you so much for sharing details in with such a deep perspective. Thank you so much for sharing your insights and experience on sustainable livelihoods for women, particularly in rural and semi-urban areas in India, and also giving very deep view about how we can unlock economic opportunities, open up new opportunities for women, particularly by strengthening financial independence. Thank you so much for dropping by and taking the time out to have this conversation with us.